There you go.
You probably don't realize how nice it is to sit where I am and look at all of you. It's really very nice, especially this far into the retreat. Before I get started on my talk, I'd like to say that it's kind of amazing for me to be here with the people who are sitting up here. 17 years ago, I started sitting, and I started by going on a 10-day retreat at Yucca Valley, which was pretty excruciating, if you want to know the truth. You probably have some sense of that right now. And when I came home on a Thursday, and my wife was waiting, and she said, after all the usual things, you know, that kind of stuff, she said, you know, while you were gone, I found a Vipassana group in Santa Cruz, and they're meeting tonight. And so I went to Vipassana Santa Cruz, where Mary Grace was teaching. So, you know, what's really remarkable about that is, well, many things, actually. You know, a friendship that has grown during that time. You know, the encouragement and the teaching I received from her. But also just the knowledge of how much support we have for practice now in our community. You know, a lot longer ago than that, when I was in my early 20s, I was still very interested in practice, and there was nowhere to practice. There was nowhere where you could receive instruction. There was no support. There were no sitting groups. And so what happened to me was exactly what you would expect. You know, my desire to practice went dormant until it could find the right growing conditions, which it fortunately did. But we don't really have to worry about that so much anymore, since we have such incredible support for practice, which you're experiencing here, and which we have the good fortune to have a retreat center only a few miles from where many of us live. So don't take that for granted. It's really an exceptional, extraordinary support and opportunity for all of us. It's also, you know, wonderful to see now how strong the center is, and that upon Mary Grace's wonderful retirement to Hawaii, it moved into the hands of Bob Stahl and the other teachers at the center, and continues to thrive and be strong and bring new people into the practice. So for that, I'm really grateful and want to acknowledge it. So thank you.
I didn't retire.
I don't know, you didn't. This guy, I went to visit her a month ago in Hawaii, and you just recreated your life there that you had here. But you said you were going to retire.
Sort of. Uh-huh. Live sanely.
So, sometimes I think about the process of retreat. Particularly early on, you know, I know for a number of you this is your first retreat, but even for those of you who have a lot of experience, one way of thinking about this process is that we're actually just in the very simple process of trying to make room, in our hearts to clean out a bunch of junk that we really don't need anymore, and we know that we don't need it, and to find a new way of being. Maybe you notice, since you've been here, that there's a lot of thinking going on, a lot of radio interference from your local monkey radio station, and probably a lot of physical discomfort also. All of this actually became pretty clear in our first round of practice interviews today, practice discussions. It's always a privilege to be in those discussions and to make contact with really the heart of practice. But also, it's not surprising to hear some comments over and over again. Some I heard today were, what was I thinking? Or will I ever be able to do this? Or my mind is just crazy. I think those comments occur at every single retreat and every interview, and I know that we've all felt that way. But also, along with this, from my perspective, was a lot of evidence of progress on the path, even in these few short days, and a kind of progress which maybe you aren't even aware of yourself. So we're kind of moving around in the territory that's described in the Satipatthana Sutta. Maybe you've heard that mentioned the last couple of days. And one of the wonderful things about the Satipatthana Sutta is this promise that when practiced diligently, you will awaken in only 7 days. So there's the good news. The bad news is you're only going to be here for 5 so today. But there's still some good news. And if you haven't discovered it for yourself, I'd like to take a few minutes to relate to you what I'm seeing. So there are many things that you have already accomplished. You might think for a moment of the first day that we were here when we took the refuges and the precepts. And perhaps it's occurred to you that you already had some refuges that you were using before you came here. And they might have been things like the internet or Game of Thrones or a glass of wine or running and working out or whatever it was that gave you some relief from your daily struggle and made your life a bit easier. Okay? Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. All fine. But you might have also had the sense that that stuff maybe wasn't quite working all of the time. And maybe its effect was a bit limited and you actually wanted more. So this, I think, led to, and a number of you expressed this, the desire for some new opening, some way of taking refuge that offered a bit more. And so you were willing to come here on that first night and take refuge in the triple gem of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and probably you weren't quite clear, or many of you were not quite clear, exactly what it was that you were getting into. But there was a willingness, you know, and there was a desire to try something new. And so now you're in the process of trying that on. What might this new refuge offer? What is its flavor? Does it feel fitting enough that you would choose to explore it further? Perhaps the Triple Gem has actually been your refuge for a while and you've come to deepen your life in the Dharma. So already you can see that there is wisdom, that there is the wisdom enough to know that something was missing, and the wisdom to begin an inquiry that might lead to more freedom, to less suffering. So we took the refuges, and then right afterwards we took the precepts, the 5 training precepts. Krishnamurti said that the understanding of the false is the discovery of the true. I like to think of the precepts in this way. It takes the kind of thou shalt not flavor that we might detect in the precepts and focuses attention on what might appear, what might be released or freed when we practice the precepts. So we take the precept not to kill, so that the impulse for kindness might be released. We take the precept not to steal so that we may look at the rising of generosity, the impulse for generosity. And we take the precept not to misuse our sexuality in order that we may come to think about respect, about not objectifying each other, about allowing the fullness of our humanity to be seen. We take the precept not to lie so that the truth that might grow out of that is the desire for truth-telling, for gentleness in speech, for learning the wholesomeness of silence and reevaluating the necessity for constant speech. And we take the precept not to cloud the mind in order that the mind may become clear. The understanding of the false is the discovery of the true. So now we're in an environment where we can examine the effects of these very significant pledges we have taken on. Just in the 2 days that we've been together, I'm often amazed at the displays of simple consideration and kindness which become so common in this new framing that we create together. It's really a paradigm for a community that is wholly different from the one we commonly dwell in. By taking the precepts together, we have committed to creating a community that is harmonious and supportive of awakening. No small thing in only a few days. So now we're working to become meditators. Sometimes looking at the breath is difficult. Maybe you've noticed this. It's like looking at nothing at all, often. It's difficult to find easy to lose track of, to feel lost. We are just asking our normal guide, the mind, to step aside for a while. We need another teacher now. The poet Paul Strand says in one of his poems, "To stare at nothing is to learn by heart. To stare at nothing is to learn by heart." So we learn slowly and well. Just a bit at a time. Ajahn Chah has wisely described for us the first steps. He says, "I've often taught that tranquility is stillness. Flowing is wisdom. We practice meditation to calm the mind and to make it still so that then it can flow. In the beginning, we learn what still water is like and what flowing water is like. And after practicing for a while, we will see how these support each other. We have to make the mind calm, like still water. Then it flows. Both being still and flowing, this is not easy to contemplate," says Ajahn Chah. Many questions and interviews about how will I know I'm making progress? How long is it going to take? The quickest way to make progress in meditation is to be perfectly content. Put your energy into being mindful in the present moment and not hoping or expecting anything. Be content. So despite all of our patience and persistence in practice, you might have bumped up against a few common obstacles on the path to awakening. And these obstacles are well known to all meditators, and the Buddha spoke of them in a very direct fashion. We call these obstacles to our meditation practice the hindrances, Nivarana in Pali. Usually people start talking about these and they tell you how bad they are and how you really got to avoid them and all the things that you can do to avoid them and the terrible things that will happen to you if you don't avoid them. But actually, I think they're really pretty great things. Hindrances are the things you experience before you have jhana. So those of you who don't know about jhana, this is a series of very extremely concentrated states that can be achieved in practice. And one of their chief features is that the hindrances are not present. But you have to have the hindrances, of course, before you can get the good stuff. And it's really good to work with these, not only in our meditation practice, but in our life. So there's many stories, many similes that the Buddha uses to talk about the hindrances. And one of these stories involves a Brahmin, a teacher, a priest, a Brahmin priest actually named Sangharava, who comes to the Buddha and says that his official duty is to know what all of the ceremonies and rituals, the prayers that are offered. And he has to know these by heart. And he comes to the Buddha and he says, that why is it that on some days I can't remember even what I have practiced well? And on other days I can remember even the prayers that I never practiced very well, including the ones I practiced really well. The Buddha says, well, this is because of the hindrances. This is because of the hindrances. And then he goes on to explain why this is so. So he uses another simile to, when he's speaking to him, and that is a simile which involves a man who is looking for self-knowledge, and in order to acquire this, he thinks that he might want to look at his own image in a mirror, and he finds five water jugs which he looks into. The first water jug, the water is dyed. It's dyed red. And this is a simile for the hindrance of sense desire. So sense desire to our ears maybe has something, some sound like some really big deal, some really kind of awful sort of perversion, but actually it just refers to any sense desire, anything that we're reaching out for pleasure. And when the Buddha's talking about the hindrances, he's not talking about them from a moral perspective. It's not a matter of this is the wrong thing to do or this is the right thing to do. There's no moral implication at all. It's simply what gets in the way of our practice, what gets in the way of calming the mind. So perhaps you can think of how sense desire might do this. Any of the six senses can be the source of this sense desire. The obvious ones of tasting, touching, smelling, seeing, hearing, but also the mind, right? Of planning and fantasizing and imaging and remembering, you know, while we're sitting. Mostly all of these things are harmless. They don't really hurt anyone. You're sitting here composed. You have a certain amount of calmness. And all of a sudden, you have a very pleasant memory of something that happened to you. And you go, well, that's really nice. And you kind of sit back and kind of settle into that very pleasant memory for a while. And maybe that leads to another memory. And then you're just kind of out there remembering all of these wonderful times. And you're not meditating anymore. You're not calming the mind anymore. The mind is sort of very nicely occupied with something that we really are enjoying. We're really enjoying that. So we think about something, and then we think about how we might prolong that, make it last a little bit longer, or how it might lead to something even more enjoyable. We have a lot of investment in pleasure seeking. Now, we all know that. We all go for the good stuff. No? We want the ice cream and the Cabernet and the good stuff, right? And this is something that is just built in. We just have this. We don't have to, like, go to school to learn how to do this. You know? We know how to go after the stuff that's pleasant. So we're continually kind of scanning around, looking for what is going to feel good, what's going to be the easy way, what's going to entertain us. Even when you came here, you walked in that door, and you looked around this room, and you went, where's going to be the best place for me to sit? You know, I like to be in a corner. I like to be by the window. I don't want anybody to see me. I want to be right in front. You know, we've all got our idea about that best place, all right. When we get what we want, it's a pretty pleasant thing. We're generally happy about that. But maybe we also notice that it doesn't last very long. And that because we want that pleasant sensation, we start looking for the next thing that's going to provide it. Or we start looking for a better thing. So this pleasure seeking really takes control of our ability to establish attention. You know, establish attention, in our case, on the breath. Right? To work in our meditative practice. It takes us away from that. And that is why it hinders the development of practice. It's not that it's bad. It's not that it's wrong. It just keeps us from doing what we came here to do. So in the second water jar, the water is boiling. And this also makes it very difficult to for this particular person to get a clear image of themselves. And this is the allusion here is to ill will. Right? Again, this doesn't have to be something big. It doesn't have to be a lot of rage, a lot of anger. It can be something, and most frequently is something, quite small, quite unremarkable, quite not blameworthy at all. You know? It can be as simple as being in the food line behind someone who just happens to have taken 4 cookies. Which in your mind is about 3 too many. And it occurs to you that you never would have done that. And that if they're taking 4 cookies, you might not get as many as you would like to have. And since you're the kind of person who would never do that, you must be a better person than that person who took 4 cookies. Don't you think so? You wouldn't have done that. No. So this kind of ill will always has this kind of coloring, first of all, of aversion, right? We don't like this thing that we're seeing. There's something wrong with it. Or there's something, and it's almost always a person too. It's not usually a thing. Like, we don't have ill will about that stack of zafus, you know, or this bell. They're not really doing anything to affect us. So it's almost always about people. You know? It could be because you're sitting next to that person who breathes really loudly when you sit very silently and upright and never make any noise while you're breathing. And how irritating that is to you, and how you wish they would move across the room, or they would learn how to breathe like you do, perfectly. Yeah. So this kind of gets in your way when you're trying to meditate, when you're trying to calm the mind, because the mind now is going, this is driving me crazy. You know? There's no peace there. There's no calm there. You know? Again, it's not a big thing. You haven't actually said anything to this person. You haven't offended anyone. There's nobody can point a finger at you and say, really, you shouldn't behave that way, because nobody knows, right? Nobody knows what you're thinking. But the mind cannot be calmed in that circumstance. It's not possible. So this making yourself better in a sort of unconscious way, actually, just the very fact that you are internally criticizing, diminishing what this other person is doing, you're creating this self. every moment that you do that, this self that is better than, this self that would never do that thing. You know? And this gets us in all kinds of trouble, especially outside of meditation, you know, which we frequently do this while we're not in this rooms like this or on the cushion. But this is frequently our behavior when we're out in the world, this comparing mind. Now, I'm not going to talk about that because I kind of want to keep it focused on what's happening in meditation. So the third hindrance and the third vessel is a vessel that is covered, where the water is covered with moss. And you can't really see into it. So this simile is meant to indicate what unfortunately is always called sloth and torpor. I'm sure you use those two words all the time in your conversations with your friends. I don't know why we use them, except that I think the translations that occurred in English in the early 20th century, that was maybe a common way of dealing with this. In its most common form, it's sleepiness. Sleepiness. But sleepiness is kind of tricky. It turns out that it's not always just what we think of as a kind of honest fatigue. All right, you come here on the first day, and in the first full day that you're here, you realize that you're actually really tired, and this is very common. It's pretty legitimate. You know, you probably all come from a very busy life. You have no idea about how tired your busy everyday life makes you, and you arrive here and you have nothing to do, and all of a sudden your body goes, I am a wreck. No, I'd like to just sleep for a few days, please. Thank you. And you know, and that's totally understandable, legitimate fatigue, which we can pay attention to in different ways. And I think it's totally legitimate, you know, on the first day of a retreat to be aware of that, to take some additional rest. That's fine. But after that point, we kind of need to pay attention to it in a little firmer way. We need to work with this sleepiness, because otherwise we're not going to be in this hall. We're going to be in bed, right? And this is what we came to do, isn't it? Right? We're here? Okay. So that's one aspect of it. And from where I'm sitting, I just love looking out at people get sleepy. It's so hilarious sometimes. Sorry, but, you know. So for my own sleepiness, I usually just do the basic head snap, you know. That's mine. But other people have other things that they do. They kind of can just kind of cave in like this. Or there's all kinds of forms that it takes, and it's pretty obvious when it's happening. So the way that we have to work with this is we have to become really very conscious of how sleepiness occurs in the body, right? At a much earlier point than we're used to. You know, we usually notice sleepiness when it's actually too late. That point, you know. But we can pay attention to our bodies and notice that there actually are some signs that occur much earlier than that, right? So it usually has to do in some fashion with our sense of balance, right? So there is, you know, this subtle kind of leaning, a kind of sense of unstableness that we might have. Or it may be, a closing of the eyes, a kind of unwilling. So lots of small things that we can be paying attention to so that we can raise some effort to keep ourselves awake and alert. In very simple ways, actually, in the beginning, simply by opening the eyes. That would be maybe the first way, to open your eyes when you're sitting. Right? Sometimes that's all that's required. Adjusting your posture, you know. I know this is how I often catch it in myself, is when I'm sitting and I notice that my shoulders are rounding a bit. Somebody told me there's actually a word in Thai for this, and I think it's mu in or something like that, and it means rounding over. So, you know, you're sitting and you kind of, the body's just kind of rounding over. It's kind of caving in a bit. So sometimes, you know, if you can notice that, it's simply a matter of just checking your posture again, bringing yourself more to an upright, erect posture. That's all that's necessary. More extreme ways, we might need to stand up. Usually, this sleepiness is short-lived. Right? We can get over it in a fairly short period of time by doing one of these things. But there's another kind of sleepiness that's a little more subtle, and it's actually a form of aversion. It's a kind of sleepiness that comes because we don't want to be here. We don't want to be here. And so the body goes to sleep. I really don't want to be in the hall right now, even though I drug myself here and I made myself come. I really want to be back in my room or walking out in the woods. And so the body reacts to that by kind of helping you out, helping you to not be here and going to sleep. Right? Now that form of sleepiness is totally accessible to you and under your control. Right? You can definitely do something about it. And it's very... It's a very informative thing to be aware of, you know, to understand this message about aversion, about not wanting to be here. It's a point. It's a good point to begin an inquiry, which would be something about, oh, why? Why is this? So. The fourth of the hindrances has the water vessel agitated. It's all stirred up so that you can't, again, get a clear image. And this simile is used to invoke the notion of the restless mind, restlessness. One teacher that I frequently pay attention to says... describes restlessness as the body's attempt to entertain itself. And he says that what happens is that Mara sends her boys out to get you. It's sort of this gangster image where you kind of get tortured in a way. You know, you're just sitting there, but you just cannot stay still. And there are perhaps all of these kinds of maybe itching sensations or tingliness or lots of things happening in the body. Like maybe imagine Mara sending her boys or this kind of impish people coming around and tweaking you here and pulling you there. And, you know, just like you just cannot sit still. You know? You can't do it. And it doesn't seem to end. And that makes it very difficult for us to be still. Very difficult. And there's a very... kind of simple way of dealing with this, which you might not feel very satisfactory, but here's the antidote. When you sit down, make yourself as comfortable as you possibly can right away. Get all the wrinkles out of your socks and your pants so they don't like bother you. Get yourself really comfortable, and then don't move. Don't move, no matter what happens. Just don't move anymore, that's all. The itch comes, the pinchy feeling comes, all of that stuff is happening. You just don't move. You don't move, okay? This is actually a wonderful way to practice, right? To be able to be mindful of all of these body sensations, how they arise and how they pass away and how long they last. And the impulses that arise with them, like the impulse to scratch right away when you feel an itch, can you not do that? You know, what is that experience like? So the last of the hindrances is represented by a water vessel again that is situated in a dark place where there's no light to provide the reflection. And this simile points to the fifth hindrance, which is doubt. Doubt. So doubt is a really unpleasant sensation. It's actually an emotion. Right? It's a very strong emotion. It's considered to be one of what are called the flooding emotions, together with anger and anxiety. can be very overwhelming. And it's overwhelming because we feel that there's nothing that we can do about it. And our normal way of approaching it is to try and think our way out of it. We try to think our way out of it. We try to come up with rationalizations and systems of thoughts and concepts that will somehow dispel the doubt. And unfortunately, all of that thinking actually reinforces it. So, doubt undermines our ability to act. If you think about this, I'm sure we've all had this experience that we sit, we're confronted with a situation that maybe is very important, crucial. We don't actually know what the right thing is to do. And we don't know whether to move to the right or to the left. We're really kind of paralyzed, right? This is this flooding part of this sensation that it really paralyzes us. It makes us unable to act. Doubt is where we have a big question mark, where we feel there shouldn't be a big question mark. We really feel that this particular area is something we should know about and we should have some certainty about, and we at the same time realize we don't. We don't. And we can't create that certainty. So the resolution to this is not something that we actually find on the cushion. It's something that we really have to work with in our lives. But the way that we can deal with it on the cushion seems very simplistic and maybe dismissive to you, but it's not actually. And the resolution is to stop thinking. Stop thinking about it. You know, the thinking is not going to resolve it. It's far beyond our ability to think it away. Right? So we leave it alone. We set it aside. So at the end of this simile, the Buddha says that to the Brahmin that the reason that he is not able to remember these things is that he doesn't know how to escape from the five hindrances. And that's what's necessary, is to know how to escape. So I think I skipped the escape mechanism for ill will. Maybe I won't tell you. It's compassion, huh? It's compassion. So that person who took those four cookies in front of you in the line, don't have to be thinking of them in the way that they're depriving you. You can simply show compassion towards them, you know, in that instance. That's the escape route from being frozen in ill will in your practice. So this working with the hindrances, I think, points to the importance of working with the heart in practice. Right? It's very difficult to think our way through these things. They're all very common things, you know. As I said, not just experienced on the cushion while you're meditating. They're experienced in our life. You know? If we think about the person who took the four cookies, it's pretty easy for us in thinking about it to arrive at the conclusion, well, this is just a greedy person who doesn't care if I get any cookies or not. That's my best thinking. No, but my heart might be able to come to a completely different place. So I want to finish by reading a poem actually by Emily Dickinson. It's kind of a geography lesson, a really nice geography lesson, I think. She writes, "The heart is the capital of the mind. The mind is a single state. The heart and the mind together make a single continent. One is the population. Numerous enough. This ecstatic nation, seek, it is yourself. Let's just sit together for a moment. So thank you so much for your attention this evening and the period of walking practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.